Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining the show. I'm Karen. Tonight we are going to be talking with John E. and about his journey to recovery. So I'm going to introduce him now. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good, Karen. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on tonight.
Yes, introduce myself. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. And going to try to share a little bit of my story with you, maybe hope of recovery for somebody out there.
And, okay. Okay, well, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and how everything began.
Sure, yeah. You stop me if you need me to talk or ask me something, and we'll go from there. But my name is John. I grew up in a small town in the Texas Panhandle. Out in the country, it is a place called Mule Shoe, Texas. And it's, spelled just like that, like a mule and a shoe. And grew up in a small farm, common, big family. Had a lot of brothers and sisters, so we were always out doing something out in the farm and stuff. But, never much alcoholism in my house. My dad would, be the type of person who drank sometimes a Saturday night beer. Sometimes it'd be, a summertime beer or something, nothing big. So I didn't grow up around a bunch of alcohol. Now, my uncles, on the other hand, my dad's brothers, those were my heroes. Those were the kind of guys that played a lot of music. My dad and everybody, they were all musical family. I would love it when they came down on the Saturday evenings. And we'd all sit outside and run around, and they'd sit around playing all kinds of musical instruments and laughing and drinking beer, of course. I remember at probably about the age of 12 or 13 approximately, don't remember exactly, but I do remember that me and my cousins, I don't remember which ones they were at the time, it was a bunch of us, decided to sneak a beer out, and where they might have grabbed a couple of them or something out of a cooler. We run off to the back of the house and jumped into a cornfield back there. We live in the country, like I said. And I remember the effects of that first beer. Now, it actually made me feel like somebody. And I remember, because I kind of grew up pretty shy in school and stuff. I didn't have many friends. I didn't fit in. Actually, I didn't have any friends, in first grade and stuff. I would just stand around, and got to the point that I'd get picked on a lot. So by the time I was 12 or 13, I didn't have much courage in school, didn't have any friends. Except my cousins, when they came over, we were all together. But I remember that feeling of that alcohol. I do remember that feeling. It was just an awesome feeling it gave me. It gave me a numbness to my face. I remember that. And I remember this feeling of, wow, this is awesome. I'm in heaven. And that was the first touch of alcohol I had. But I don't know how long it was before I could get another drink of alcohol. But I do know that it never, ever left my mind after that. It was a small obsession with me, always thinking about the next time I would get me a drink, get another beer like that. I know now that that was the first sign of alcoholism because I had that obsession of it. It never left me. And it may have been a while, 6 months, a year, I don't remember, before I was able to do that again. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, wow, when I grow up, now I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to become a musician like my uncles, and I'm going to be able to get me my own beer, have my own vehicle, and things. And sure enough, that's what I did. Time in this part of the country, time you're 16, 17 years old, or back then, you start working your first jobs, you get away, and start doing things, buy your vehicle. You know, I had to get all my own stuff because I had to work for it. You know, we were, like I said, a large family, mom and dad. Dad was a farm worker, and, you know, we didn't get anything bought for us really other than necessities.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing I did, you know. I learned where the bootleggers lived in town. I learned how to get out, and I learned how to buy my own alcohol. I think by the time I was 17, 18 years old, I was a full-blown alcoholic. Well, you know, I'd start off with a weekend. You know, like anybody else, Saturday night was, we still had a drive-in show, get beer for that. Then it'd grow to, well, I'm going to do Friday and Saturday, you know. Then Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, you know, and it started up till it built up to an everyday type of drinking. You know, it didn't take me long to be a full-blown, I consider now alcoholic. Back then, I just thought I was a party kind of guy. And that is what gave me the courage, I guess, to go on and talk to girls, little things like that I couldn't do without it. You know, I was a shy person without it, and I had found my solution to all that. That was my solution to the world. I wasn't afraid of anything, you know. But like anything, it wasn't long before I worked my way to DWI, you know. And I remember thinking, man, I've got to quit this. I've got to quit doing all this all the time. Which, you know, that probably lasted all of a couple of days, you know. And I was right back to it again. And I worked at this little company. And I don't know exactly what years it was and stuff, but I lost my first job because I couldn't get up and meet, you know, certain things. At that same time, though, I had grown to start playing music with my uncles and stuff. We'd get out, and they asked me to play with them, so I picked up an instrument. I picked up the bass. I said, yeah, I can learn this, and, you know, and I did. It didn't take me long to learn how to play music. We had a little country combo to play, and we played all over the state of New Mexico and little clubs and stuff. And so, basically I was in heaven. You know, of course, beer drinking went along with music back in those days, and so we did play a lot of stuff. And that type of life, it continued on for, quite a while, you know, several years. And till I was, probably, you know, I picked up a DWI, like I said, and I was probably about the age of 25 when I kind of dropped that type of life off, you know, off. I'd had a couple of even wrecks and stuff. I'd wrecked vehicles and done all this, and I'd swear off of it, said I'm not going to drink anymore. You know, I'd make promises, tell my mom I'm not going to continue drinking. But, you know, those things, I guess, you don't realize it at the time. You just think you enjoy drinking and stuff, but, that was all. I remember missing my own birthday party, my mom making me a cake and sisters, and I didn't get home till midnight drunk, and there was my cake on the table. You know, I had these guilt feelings about it, but I just couldn't seem to stop and control it. I remember missing my mom's birthday parties, little things. I remember one incident that really made me feel guilty, and I remember my mom, I was living at home at the time, and sending me to town. Hey, John, I need you to go pick your dad's medicines up. He is, you know, some antibiotics. Dad was sick. He was, you know, doctor gave him some stuff. He had some kind of flu or something, and, I mean, he was really, really sick. So I took him down, picked up the medicines, and decided I was going to stop at this local VFW out in the country, which would let anybody in. It didn't matter what age you were back then. You know, they just wanted the money. And the magic number, I'm just going to have two, you know. That's, I've heard that magic number so many times, just two, you know. And those two, I didn't get home, you know. You know, dad over there suffering, needing his medication, and here I am, you know, at this old place, drinking and not able to make it home till closing time, you know. And that kind of stuff, I'd swear, you know, I'm not going to do this again. I'm going to, you know, I've got to quit. But, you know, and sometimes I could quit a whole 2 days or something, then go right back to it. And I remember at approximately the age of 25, I think, when I finally hit that age,
I had a pretty bad accident, and I ended up, you know, had a cousin driving. He was underage cousin, and we ended up in an accident in New Mexico somewhere, ended up in jail and stuff, and I swore I will never do this again, you know. And I actually managed to quit alcohol at that time. I didn't know anything about AA programs or anything about, you know, NAAA or anything like that. I had no idea what they were. I'd heard about them, but I thought those were for real drunks, you know, that's what I thought. So that didn't fit me in any way, you know. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't have thought of that. But I remember not drinking for several years at that point. It wasn't a good experience. It was an experience full of anxiety. And I realize now that I didn't know how to live without alcohol at that time. I remember quitting alcohol. I had, you know, and I started exercising, lost weight, got in shape, started running, but I could not stop doing things. If I went to go visit, let's say, my mom, I had my own apartment by then, and go visit mom or something, I couldn't stay more than 15 minutes. I couldn't sit down. I didn't realize those were all symptoms of things. You know, I had to keep going, had to work more than one job, had to, I couldn't sleep at night, you know, just kept going and going. And survived life for quite a while, and I went out and picked up dancing, and I loved to go out there and talk to the ladies and girls and whatnot, you know, and just all over these little towns around here in Texas. You know, I thought I was having a lot of fun, and I was, but I had to keep going. There was no relaxation for me, you know. I was basically what we call white-knuckling it, you know, and just gritting my teeth and trying not to drink, you know, and but I didn't know how to live without it, live with those anxieties that were so strong that I just kept going, you know. And I ended up meeting a girl, and we dated for quite a while, and I ended up getting married. We got married and had a big wedding, had all the stuff going, and I was working two jobs, trying to, you know, making things go and making ends meet. And I think people saw me as this hard-working young man that, you know, of course, I wasn't that young anymore. I think I'd already quit drinking for a while. So I was probably about 29 at the time when I finally decided to settle down and get married. And working a couple of jobs at a time. And people thought I was just this hard-working type of person, when in reality, I was not. I mean, I did it because I had to. You know, my anxieties were still there. You know, at the time, I didn't realize what was going on with me, you know. I just knew I had to keep going and going and going. And so I'd work these two jobs, sometimes three jobs, and it worked out because I, you know, had enough money to start a family. But it had nothing to do with me being a hard worker. It had everything to do with you know, just keeping myself going. You know, in between that, too, before that, I had, you know, I'd already lost more than one job also and had more than one wreck beyond that, too, you know. And just little things that I skip around sometimes because it's hard to place all my life together in one spot. But a lot of incidents that happened to me at this point. And it was all due to alcohol, every bit of it. But when I, you know, after I got married, I didn't drink. I really knew that I shouldn't drink. I didn't consider myself an alcoholic because I didn't know what an alcoholic was. But deep inside me, I knew already. I had tested the water several times, quit drinking a few here, a few days here, and always knew that if I just took one drink, I was back on it again. And deep inside, I knew that I should never drink again. But my father-in-law at the time liked to have his Saturday night beers and stuff, and I'd go over and I wouldn't drink, you know. And I remember my wife, which is actually now my ex-wife, would tell me, why can't you just drink a beer with my dad? He wants some company. Can't you just drink a beer with him or something once in a while? And so I thought, well, you know, I guess it's been a lot of years since I drank. She finally talked me into it. And I remember again that first drink I had during that time. It put me right back in heaven again. I relaxed. Everything was perfect again. The problem was that it started that obsession of alcohol once again. There was nothing I could do to stop it. You know, I could stop. And I was living in misery because I'd stop for a week because I knew it wasn't right to drink every day. I'd stop for a week and I'd wait for the weekend to come. And that's all I would think about. Alcoholism puts something in your mind. It is such a phenomenal craving that we have, we as alcoholics get. And I remember that that's the only thought you have in your mind sometimes. It does never leave you. Yes, you can function and do other things, but the thought of the next drink is always in your mind. You know, some people can go days without drinking and still alcoholics, you know, and I could do that, but I was white knuckling it all the time. I'd go sometimes a month without drinking, but that obsession would never leave me. And the more you drink, the harder it gets, the worse it gets. And pretty soon, it wasn't long before I was having marital problems, you know, real quick. You know, it didn't take me long. So I knew I had to quit, you know. And I would quit for a while. Like I said, I would quit, not drink. I had my child, you know, had a first daughter born. And so I quit. But without help, that obsession always takes over again. Your body does not know how to relax. Your mind cannot relax. You're, you know, emotionally, mentally, physically, spiritually, you can't relax. And so I just keep, you know, kept drinking, you know. And it's funny how I could do it for a little while, but it would keep, you know, I'd keep going back to it. Ended up having another child, and I'd quit again for a while and keep going, and we'd get into these big arguments, and she'd want to leave me and everything, and I'd swear up I'd quit again, and I would for a while. Then at that time, I was working for a grocery store, you know, and I'd work my way up to management, you know, and I started off as just part-time, and one of my part-time jobs, and you know, and I did always have this drive, I guess this drive to keep going just so I could quit drinking. I would throw myself into some kind of work, and that way I wouldn't, you know. I've done several jobs between that, but, you know, one of them was a lumber yard. One was a, you know, different things. In between when I quit drinking, I worked as a security guard in dance halls and, you know, bounce as a bouncer, basically is what it was, I guess, in these rough dance halls, one of my weekend jobs. And so I ended up working at this grocery store and climbing management and did real well. I mean, I was up there doing management work. And then here comes my new boss, the new store director, and he's an alcoholic, you know. Well, of course, I had to drink with a new guy, you know, so here I go again. You know, little things like that just kept happening in my life, you know, and I didn't know how to say no. And there came a point, you know, that we as alcoholics, we try to change our lives to get away from things. We change locations, we change jobs, we change everything. We try to, you know, try to do something different to get away from the drinking. We know we need to get away from the drinking, whether we realize we're alcoholics or not. So we try all kinds of location changes, job changes, and things like that. And one of the things I did at the time, and a lot of it was to prove something. And about that time, and you know, several years had gone by already, and I'd been through this stuff, and held on tight to the family. We were able to survive, but I got married. You know, I started having kids when I was about 30 or 31. You know, it's, you know, like I said, I'd already been up in my age. I'd done so much partying and stuff that I didn't get married till then. So, at approximately 10 years into this, white knuckling it and drinking and having marital problems and little things like that, out of nowhere, I decided to make another career change. Of all things, you know, I had a friend of mine who was a police officer, and I said, you know what? I can do that too. And I'll have to quit drinking if I do that. So you know, so I did. I went to this academy and worked and went to school. And, of course, everybody, my in-laws, may say, man, look at John Boy. He is something else. He is working. He's going to go to put himself in school. And he's doing all this. And I did it to keep myself busy so I couldn't, you know, so I wouldn't drink. I kept white knuckling it, you know, and I sure did. I made it, and I graduated right top of the class with the other guy, a couple of others there, and got a job, had two job offers immediately in my hometown there, and took them on. And I thought, wow, this is it. You know, I can't drink, even though, you know, I'm a cop now. You know, I'm a police officer. I got to be respectful and do that. But it didn't take long before I started hiding it, you know, drinking again, hiding little things. And about that time during the academy, my son was born too. At that time, like I said, I was already older. I was 40 years old when I graduated that. And it was in 2005 at this point. And my son was born. And I knew I had to quit, you know. And I did for a little while. Like I said, I would quit here and there, but I would start over again and get obsessed. And I just, you know, and marriage was just a kind of fleeting thing there. I had a family and everything, but I think she was kind of tired of me too. And she'd stay a lot with her mom at times, and we'd still have a good family going, and then we'd go back and forth, you know, never leaving each other, but, you know, we weren't quite communicating anymore. It started about that time, I guess, not quite having the communication we should have. And about that time, you know, I got switched over to the county. I took a job on with the county as a sheriff's deputy, and, you know, and I climbed my way up to a chief deputy. You know, I was, you know, I had this ambition, and I could do things, and always climbing. And you'll find that in alcoholics a lot of times, a lot of talent, a lot of things they can do, whether it's musical, art, or something, you know. But I was able to just actually climb a ladder that quick, you know, in law enforcement, investigations and stuff. And I, like I said, again, I would quit for a while. And but it got to where, you know, beer was hard for me to hide, you know. So I started getting into harder stuff, started getting into vodka, you know. That way I could have a quick fix, mix it with something else. And it turned pretty bad for me. It didn't take long, you know, with, you know, of course, when you start drinking that much alcohol, you know, it goes pretty rough. And I remember I would do a lot of crazy stuff, you know. During this time, too, my father-in-law was killed in a car wreck, you know, coming home from work. He worked at the power plant out there, and one morning he was coming home, and I had slept in that morning. I told my wife, we were during some of the good times, you know, said, hey, let's just sleep in a little bit. She had to go to work. She called in, yeah. So about that time, her mom calls and says that her dad had a wreck. Of course, they didn't know how bad it was. You know, they heard he hit a horse or something, and okay, but nobody knew what, you know. So I said, well, let's go see how they're doing. So I said, let me take a quick shower. I called, you know, my boss. I said, hey, I'm going to be running a little late. And it's a good thing I wasn't in response to that accident, I guess, because actually he'd end up getting killed on it. And so, you know, that was a real bad thing for the family and stuff. And I just went, you know, it went bad for me, you know, just I started drinking again at that point. And she started staying with her mom. And to me, it was just another excuse to really drink. My son would come home with me. You know, he was little. He was 5 years old or so at that time. And, you know, my dad had passed away, too, in between there, just to, you know. And so I had that. I had friends pass away. My dad had passed away because my dad had passed away, you know, from sickness, old age and stuff. And then, but that, when that happened, a year later, that was when my father-in-law passed away. Or got killed. And that really way up there. And it was an everyday obsession. I don't know how I held my job during that time. I hung on to it for another year, probably trying to hide what I was really doing, you know, just, you know, and to me, with her staying with her mom and me and my son at home, it's, you know, it was just an open door for me to just drink and drink and drink and drink till I finally caved in and crashed. And it was, it wasn't pretty. You know, they had to come and get me out of the house, you know, one time, and I lost my career over that. They had to come and get me, and I was, you know, totally drunk. So I threw away a career at that point. And, of course, you know, I could have gotten in a lot of trouble. I had my son with me, you know, endangerment and stuff and little things like that. But that's, you know, one of the things that I really regret. And you think about it, you know, alcohol and drug abuse is such a bad thing that we do so many things. We endanger our own children. We do a lot of things. There are a lot of, you know, cravings in the world. People, you know, you can crave certain things, but there is no such thing. Nothing as hard as the craving of alcohol or drugs. You know, there's food cravings, mm-hmm. there's sugar cravings, all kinds of things like that. But none of them will make you do stupid things like put your own family in dangers of things, you know, having your own child in a vehicle, things like that, things you would not normally do, things you regret, things you know are wrong, and yet the cravings are so strong for either, you know, drugs or alcohol that you will endanger, that you will throw away careers for them, you know. And I think back on that stuff and I reflect on it now, and I kick myself hard sometimes thinking about those things. And but that's when I first discovered the program. I had one of my sisters who also worked in law enforcement with me at the time. She hauled me in to find somebody. I called somebody who, you know, I said, I need help. I just don't know what to do. So I called a friend who I knew had, you know, had been some kind of a, you know, alcoholic at one time, and or who was an alcoholic in programs, and he referred me to another friend of mine, to another guy that we tried to be my first sponsor. I remember to this day very clearly, I was just, you know, walking to his front door, and I felt about 6 inches tall, you know, there's just nothing, you know. And one of the reasons being is that this same person had been in jail, and I had been, you know, one of the guys that got him committed to a, you know, treatment center and stuff, you know, and he stayed sober, but he was, you know, had gotten off his meds and stuff. And this one person that I'd had in jail, and I'd known him a lot of, you know, all my life and stuff, was the one person that could help me. You know, I'd send him to a rehab. I'd send him to a treatment center so he could get him back on meds again. And here I was, needing his help at this time, you know, the guy, the cop had locked him up and put him away and done all this stuff, you know, helped him out with it, you know. And I'm glad I helped him at that time. I'm glad I, you know, I never did turn my back on him, and I'm glad I got him the help. But still, you know, you look back and you think, wow, now I'm needing his help. Here I am dragging my butt over here, you know. You know, I kind of thought like everybody looked at me like, oh, he's Mr. Perfect. He's the top. He's all this. And here I was needing the help of somebody who had been there, you know. And I remember, you know, knocking on his door. He opened the door. He knew who I was. And I told him, hey, all I could think of was, I need help, you know. He looked at me. He goes, asked me what it was. I said, alcohol. And you know what an alcoholic does who is an AA program person? They don't look down at another person. I learned that's the first thing I learned at that point. He could have told me, no, you had me in jail. You had this. You did that. What he did for me was, come on in. Let's sit down. Let's talk about this. Let's figure this out. And I went in, and I think that was in 2011. You know, I know a lot of years have flown by. I've talked about a lot of years in here just kind of skipping through them. But I kind of wanted to get to this part about him helping me out. I went in and I sat down, and from that point, he started hauling me to meetings and stuff. We went to a place called Clovis, New Mexico. They had a pretty good AA meeting going over there, real good meeting, in fact. And I'd go make these meetings. how to learn how to chair meetings, and just helped out as much as I could. Went at that for a while. I think I lasted there about a year at that meeting there. But during that time, I learned the program. One of the things I never did was, this program is about recovery, unity, and service, you know. And I didn't want, you know, I felt like I didn't have time for the whole thing. I just wanted recovery. And I remember listening to these people that walked in that place. When I walked in there, I couldn't tell that they were alcoholics. They all sounded so intelligent to me, so smart to me. They had a life. They were happy. You know, I'm thinking, how can an alcoholic be happy? You know, they were working up programs that they were doing. And that was my first mistake, I guess, in that deal. I didn't really want to work a program. I just wanted to be sober. And it's taken me years to now to realize that you have to do all those things in this program. And so I went there about a year with him and kind of got back on my feet again, you know, and I felt good, sobered up, and I felt like I had a good program going. But I started working at a different location. I started working out here where I live. I live in the middle of nowhere. So one of the areas I could drive to, everything is far from me. I started working, got back in out of law enforcement, got back into the grocery business, got me a job. They knew me yet. So, but at a different location, I went to work in a little town called Littlefield, Texas. And, still there now, in fact. But I went there. And I started leaving that program. I left my program, my Alcoholics Anonymous program. I thought I knew everything. I knew the program. You know, I'd learned everything. And that's the last thing you want to do. You would never learn everything, you know. But I did, and I quit calling my sponsor, which is the same guy, you know. I quit calling him, and it just kept going, you know, but, you know, I was working and I was, you know, still staying sober, no problem. Now, during some of this right here, I, in sobriety, everything going good. I thought everything was good. I ended up getting a divorce and it all fell in me, you know, but, you know, I had a program. I was still, at the time I quit going, but I was still working a program. And this little, you know, he had taught me, and I talked to him, and I talked to my sponsor about this too. I called him back again, and he told me, you know, there's things that are happening. You know, life still happens. You know, even just because we recover, doesn't mean that life doesn't continue. So bad things will happen to you. You know, good things, bad things, happy times, sad times. You'll lose people, and that's one of the things. Divorce came to me, and one of the good things that happened to me was that I got to keep my kids. For some reason, I don't know, issues she was having or something. She didn't want to take the kids. So I didn't have a custody battle. I didn't have anything like that. So, you know, I buckled down and I became a single dad. I think my son must've been in second or third grade by that time too, somewhere in there. And, so I was raising a small boy and two teenage daughters. I think one of them was 14, the other one about 12. And so I buckled down and I started doing, you know, I did laundry, I cooked, I took them to doctors, I applied for health insurance, you know, did everything I needed to do, and I stayed with it. And I kept my job going, you know, and my daughter, 14-year-old daughter, you know, she was having to drive to, you know, she was driving distance to school from out in the country sometimes, or taking them places and doing things we needed to do. She was helping me a lot. And so I, you know, and I continued doing that. Then, you know, one day, just out of nowhere, I decided that the, you know, when you leave a program, that obsession of alcohol, it starts sneaking up on you. You know, there's one part in that big book, you know, it calls it cunning and baffling. Alcohol is cunning and baffling if you're an alcoholic, a true alcoholic. You know, I've known a lot of heavy drinkers who could quit, drink a lot, then quit and never have any problem with it. An alcoholic, if you leave some type of program, and there's all kinds of programs, all kinds of ways to do things out there. There is, I've seen people who do it with Christian ways. I've seen people who do it AA. I've seen people do it, you know, Red Road of Sobriety and Wellbriety, and a lot of things that work, but you've got to do something, you know. And and when I left that program, it didn't take long before I started having thoughts of alcohol, you know, and you'd forget the bad things. All you remember is the happy times. And I had one alcoholic describe it to me. It's like labor pains. You know, a lady will say, I'll never do this again after having a baby, you know, and say, and it, with time, it's forgotten, you know, and they have another big family, you know, they have more children. They forget about those pains, you know, and they remember the joy, the happiness. Well, he described alcohol that way to me, the same way. You know, you forget about the pain and stuff. You forget about the things that it did to you, and you start remembering the happy times, the things it did for me. So one day I told myself, you know, John, and it wasn't a bad thing that give me this. It was actually a good thing. I had a good day at work. I was doing real good. I was raising my kids. Everything was, bills were caught up. I was, you know, had a, you know, struggling with a little money and stuff, but everything seemed to be good. And that's what gave me a thought about alcohol again. Because for me, it's always been, even if I feel good, I don't have to be sad, mad, or anything to have a craving for alcohol. In fact, the most cravings I ever had was when things were good, because if something is good, alcohol always made it better, you know. Mm-hmm. So a good feeling was very dangerous for me, you know. I was proud of myself. I was being a single dad, holding a job, doing different things, and all was good. So all of a sudden, I got this craving for alcohol that would just make it better, you know, go home and have a couple and just relax, you know, I'm doing good. I need to be patted on the back, you know, that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I didn't do it right away. But the thought hit my head, you know, I had this thought in my head at the time, and it stayed there. It turned into an obsession. At that point, I should have run right back to my program. I should have gone back and jumped into that AA program. I knew what I needed to do, but yet I didn't do it, because I still had it under control. And it stayed with me for a while. I don't know how long. I couldn't, you know, give you a time period or anything. But one day I decided I was going to go get me a six-pack. I said, you know, I think I will go out and get me a six-pack or something, and have me a few, you know, a couple of beers, and that's all I need. You know, I think I can control it now. I told myself, you know, I'm probably not an alcoholic. I'm just a heavy drinker. And I know if I could just don't drink too many, I'll be okay, you know. And that's that alcohol talking to you. That is a disease talking to you. That is a disease that works in your brain, you know. It's out there trying to, you know, defeat me at all times, it seems like. And I don't know if I did it that day or not, but I finally, one day, I remember driving. I said, you know, I'm going to go out and get this six-pack, and walk into this store, this little liquor store called Waymore's, in fact, and it's in Littlefield, Texas. See, Littlefield is the hometown of Waylon Jennings, and Waylon Jennings, if anybody knows, is a pretty big country star, and his brother and, you know, his brother James and his sister-in-law run a little liquor store on the corner of Waylon Jennings Avenue there called Waymore's. Well, I kind of knew them, so I said, you know, I'm going to go into Waymore's. That's Waylon Jennings' little place there, and I'm going to get me a six-pack. I walked in there, and I knew I should not do this, but yet I thought, well, no, I can control this. So I walked in there for a six-pack, and I came out with a 30-pack, you know, because deep inside, you know, an alcoholic knows that you're a six-pack, ain't even going to touch it, you know. But
And my thought in my head was, I'm just going to take it. That way I don't have to come back again. That way I can have enough for a month, you know, two beers. But deep inside, I guess I knew, my body knew that, you know, two beers I've drank all my life. So I knew this wasn't going to work. So, and started slowly that way again. I came home. And, you know, and I don't think I drank that day. I think I just had it there, and I didn't want to. I said, no, I don't need to drink. Well, maybe I'll just have it just in case. And I don't even know if I drank that day or not. It might have been the next day or so when I finally decided to drink a beer. And here I went, you know, again. And it wasn't long before I was, you know, beer just didn't get me there. It, you know, the alcoholism, like they say, it starts off from where you left off. It doesn't start over again. It takes off right where you left off, and it's worse. So it wasn't long before, maybe, I don't know, a week or so before, I was buying vodka, going to that way more than, and I was buying two, you know, half gallon of vodka a week or more, you know, sometimes two, you know, and I'm still trying to hide it. I remember going at this job, I was in the grocery business. I wasn't in law enforcement no more. So I was in a lot of it. I was working by myself in my own department. So I was drinking even during work and everything. Nobody, I guess they didn't know it. They didn't realize it. Nobody realized that I was drinking at the time. And I don't see how they couldn't, but they didn't, I guess. And nobody bothered me. And I was sneaking alcohol in and out of there all the time and doing different things. You know, I'd put it in Powerades, do this and do that. And always had something with me, and yet I was still trying to raise a family, you know. And right about that time, me and my ex decided to try to, you know, get back together again. Somewhere in that time there, we decided to go ahead and try it one more time for the kids. That didn't work out either. And then, of course, I was drinking again, so that was just even worse, you know. And you know, we had grown apart. You know, we thought we could fix things for the kids. It's always about the kids, fix things for the kids. But I think we had grown totally apart, you know, during my alcoholism, during her, you know, loss for her dad and stuff. You know, during times like that, we drifted apart, you know. When me being an alcoholic, she didn't really know me anymore. Her being gone, I didn't know her. You know, if you're a married couple, I believe, you know, you have to grow together and do things together. We didn't do that. We failed at that part. So when we got back together, we were basically strangers again. And, of course, I was drinking, and that didn't help matters at all. And I remember one day family was gone, and my daughter was having to do some kind of a little speech. She had won this little trip to Washington, D.C., and my oldest daughter, and it was through one of these co-op deals, electric co-ops, and she had to go make her little speech, you know, about her trip and stuff, and I could not make it because I was drinking, and I'd been drinking, and I left work early. I told him I was sick, and I'd gone, and this is just a downhill time. I mean, I was just loaded, and I was still trying to hide it. And I got home, and I got to the jumping off point, I believe. You know, they'd gone, and I got to the point where I couldn't drink anymore. I knew I couldn't drink anymore, but I couldn't not drink either. You know, it's hard to describe that point. You know, I had to have it, and yet I didn't want it anymore. You know, I wanted to end it all at that point. I'd got to the point where I didn't want to be alive because I knew I couldn't quit, and yet I couldn't live with myself anymore. That is a point that many alcoholics and addicts have reached. And you contemplate suicide. There was, before that, I had, you know, I had thought about suicide, thought about killing myself, thought it'd be easier. But, you know, of course, I didn't have the courage. I remember having just all these little odd thoughts like, well, what if something fell from the sky and, you know, and I'd be dead? You know, what if something, you know, happened like that? What if it's not my fault and I just died or something, you know, little thoughts like that. But that day earlier, I remember driving home and a booming voice hit my head, probably my own thoughts, I don't know. But it was a little turning point in my mind there. It was a point of where you
of clarity, a moment of clarity hit me at that point. I remember clearly that moment of clarity where it said, "This is not a game, John. You're going to die." Those words hit my head so clearly. And yet I knew I couldn't stop. So I went home and I said, I don't know what to do. You don't want to do. And I thought about just, you know, getting a gun and ending it right there. My family had gone to that little deal and I felt bad because I missed it. And I knew that I should have been in my program. Everything was coming to me. It just came to a head, you know, and I was totally loaded. And right before I decided to get a gun out, I decided, no, I'm going to pick up the phone. And I called the sheriff's office. And I told her I wondered if this one guy was, you know, that I talked to before that I knew. And we had talked before. I wondered if he was on duty. And he was. And I said, can you have him call me? Because they wanted to know what the problem was. I said, no. I said, I just need to talk to him. Just have him call me. So he called me and I told him, hey, you know, I don't want to live. You know, I can't control myself. I need some help or I'm fixing to do this. And he goes, don't do anything. I'll be right there. So they hauled me into the doctors in hospital in Muleshoe. And my alcohol level was like 4.7. I mean, way beyond. They couldn't believe it was that high, you know. And they couldn't take me anywhere to get help, to do anything because it was too high. You know, they wanted to check me and do this. They kept checking me, and it stayed at 4.7 all night. I mean, that's how much vodka I had drank for the last few days. It was in bad, bad shape. But, you know, such an alcoholic, they could ask me all kinds of questions, and they didn't realize how loaded I was because some of the nurses still knew me there from when I'd been in law enforcement. And they said I was very coherent. You know, I could talk, you know, they'd ask me my driver's license number and I'd rattle it off, my social security number, dates of birth. I knew everything that was going on. I mean, I just, you know, didn't have any problem there, but I had so much alcohol in me. And I knew also, I also knew that I couldn't sober up by myself. I'd probably die from DT, you know? So I got hauled off finally. And my ex helped me with this too, because, you know, we were together at the time again. And we were able to get me into a place called the Pavilion in Amarillo, Texas. And I was put into a place where they had ex-law enforcement, you know, and firefighters and military people with problems and stuff. And they were able to help me quite a bit and at least sober me up, you know, and give me more direction again. So I left that place, you know, and decided I need to get back in my program again. So I ended up going to a meeting. I called my sponsor again, and he was more than happy to hear me again. He said, hey, I knew you'd be back, you know. So I jumped in there with him, and he told me, well, there's this little place in Littlefield. It's pretty, you know, pretty popular little place. So I jumped in on that one and started working a program. And then they introduced me to one place called Level Land, Texas also. And they've got a good little, you know, programs going in these places. Of course I went in and I still had this thought in my head that, no, I just want recovery. You know, they tell me, well, you got to help others. That's part of the program, helping others and service work and all that. And, I didn't have time to help others. I didn't have time to do anything but for myself, you know. And we can be selfish people, us as alcoholics and stuff. We are selfish people. It's all about us, you know. I think the world turns around me, goes around me. And in reality, I'm just a little player in this world. But after listening to some of the guys there and talking to them and knowing where I went, you know, I started going in there at first just to warm a chair, basically what we call it. And at a certain point, I don't know, I guess I started hearing some stuff, and I guess God started working in my life. You know, I've never had a problem believing in God. Never have. I just didn't use God. And I guess he started working in my life. I started asking, you know, every day. And I heard one guy talking there, Bill. I remember him. He said the words, Every day I wake up and I ask God to grant me the desire to want to stay sober. But for some reason, that stuck in my head. That those words stuck in my head. Those are the first words that I remember that actually really, really hit me. And I thought, wow, I can do that, you know? And so I started doing that. And little things like that started working for me. And then I started realizing that during my whole life, my mom was, you know, church person. You know, I grew up Catholic church, and I never had any problem believing in God. What I learned about myself was that I quit using God as a youngster. You know, when you pray, I learned that sometimes it takes God a while to answer. You know, we use them as 911 God. 911 God, I'm in trouble. Please get me out of this one, and I will, you know, never do this again. You know, we're real big about doing stuff like that. But alcohol is bigger than God. You know, so I learned that as a youngster. And so, you know, I'd hear about people that you needed. This was a spiritual program and all. Well, you know, I thought I had that, but I really didn't, because alcohol is way quicker than God is. You know, we get our answers quick. We get relief quick with alcohol. You know, if I have a problem, if I have anxiety, if I have anything, I don't have to pray. You know, we quit praying because we have alcohol. That is the immediate answer. And so I didn't realize all that till here, you know. Well, last 4 years, I've been, this time around, I've been sober since August the 23rd of 2016. And a little over 4.5 years. And I went in this time to this program. Well, thank you very much. And, but this time, it actually feels like sobriety. Before, I was on medications for anxieties, couldn't sleep at night, couldn't do things, hard to function. Working a program and being off alcohol, I am off of those things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I wouldn't tell anybody to quit their medications if they need medications. Some people need them, you know, and never leave your medications without a doctor's advice. That's, you know, that's one thing. I don't want to make it seem like you can just leave out, you know, your medications. But I was able to, because I was able to start getting sleep again. And I started realizing that the program does work for me. You know, there's all kinds of programs out there, but you do have to put your effort into these programs. And so time with my family started getting better. I've learned that I don't have to micromanage my kids, my children, which now they're grown. They're getting bigger now. My son is the youngest one that at the time that was, you know, he is 15 now and pretty good young man. My daughters are, you know, one's in a nursing program. The other one is going to school too. The middle one, and she's in a relationship and just had a baby. I've got a brand new grandbaby. And all this I am able to enjoy because of, you know, my freedom from alcohol. There's a lot of little thoughts that come to my head, like back in the day, I needed freedom from life, you know, so I used alcohol. And then it got to the point that I needed freedom from the chains of alcohol. And to be able to get back into life. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that. But, you know, like I said, you have to work it. You have to do what they suggest. And it does work for me. It may not work for everybody, but for me it has worked. And it's given me back a life that I love now. I love life. And it's not always, you know, perfect. It's not always, you know, honey and, you know, bread or whatever. You know, there are bad times. I've lost a, you know, family members. I lost a nephew in a bad car wreck, and I've lost things like that that have happened. And so life is goes on. Life is life. Everybody has to live it. But the program helps me go through things, live a life, you know. And then I've also joined this group called Sober Indians. You know, it's a real nice little website. A lot of people on there, and you know, I've actually one of the guys there, Patrick, the one created this program, one of the peacekeepers for this, you know, kind of help with a, you know, so to me, that's a all service. I do service work. I do. And when I'm asked to do something, I try to do the best I can with it, try to help out at certain things. I've been asked, you know, speak at different places, and I'll do it now because I want to be part of this program. I don't want to be just a, you know, an observer of it. I want to work this program. I want to help others. And, that's where I'm at in my life right now. Like I said, I do things with my children. I don't miss out on things. Me and my son go hunting, fishing, I'm not missing things like I was, you know, even though I was there with them the whole time while I was drinking, I was missing out because I wasn't giving them everything. I wasn't giving them all of myself, you know. I was just giving them a shell of myself. And now I give them who I am. And I'm very happy with that. I'm happy with life now. And I'm glad to be alive. So.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
I know we're coming down to the last 30 minutes of the show, so I wanted to ask you if someone came up to you and they were looking to find, they asked you what would you suggest for them to do in order for them to get help, but then maybe they weren't too sure at that point, what would you say?
You know, and it would also depend on the condition they're in, if they need help to get dried out first and stuff, but the one thing I would ask them to do is, you know, I would take them into a program with me, and the first thing I would tell them is that they're going to have to find humility. You know, they're going to have to be humble.
Mm-hmm.
This program is about humility and giving up. It's about, you know, realizing that you cannot manage your own life, that you are not in control. And if you can do that and sit down and listen to others and follow suggestions and give up your way of thinking, because it hasn't gotten you there. It hasn't gotten you anywhere. You know, your way of thinking has only gotten you to that bad place, you know. So if you humble yourself, work a little bit of the program, you can get there. That's the only thing I could tell them. Humility.
Thank you.
That's it.
And I appreciate you coming on and talking tonight. And sharing your story. I believe that this will help others that are going through it and maybe dealing with the want to go back and to know that there is hope out there and there are people out there that's willing to help and stand up and say, hey, I'm here for you.
Well, thank you for having me on here, Karen. It was my pleasure being on this talk show, and I really hope that I did help somebody, and I just want everybody to know out there that there is hope. It's not the end of the line. You know, life does exist after a problem with alcohol or drugs. It
exactly.
is there for them.
Exactly. Well, I think you did an amazing job speaking tonight, and thank you for coming on. I enjoyed listening to you. You're very welcome. And I wanted to wish everyone a good evening, and I wanted to wish you a good evening as well.
Okay, and I'd like to wish everybody a Merry Christmas, which, you know, it's already passed, and a Happy New Year. And stay safe, everybody.
Yes. Well, you have a good evening, and until the next show, we will see you guys later. Have a good night.
Have a good night, Karen.